My gang, it's 1 o'clock, so here we are again, ready to go. So let me just scroll through my video feed. Yep, looks like lots of people are ready and excited to go. Okay, so what we're going to do now is talk about another Gottman concept. So once again, John Gottman, the guy who did this, him and his partner, like I said, Bernie, whatever his name, working on this stuff for 30 years in what they called love laboratories, weren't they? And yep. They would basically, they'd rent
Love Lab.
They'd rent a unit on the beach and they'd say to people, you can have a free weekend on the beach in exchange for allowing us to watch your interactions. And so the unit was full of cameras. And so predominantly the cameras were only in the public parts of the unit, so the lounge room, the kitchen, or whatever. Nothing in the bathrooms or the bedrooms and that kind of stuff. They were just watching normal interactions between couples. And that's where they came up with this incredible ability to predict the future of a relationship. We want to look at why that is and how they came up with it and what was at the bottom of it, because you'll find it really, really helpful to kind of step into the positive, because we talked about, you know, about what to do when things go wrong and how you might change things around. Now we need to look at, okay, well, what's the investment that you can put into your relationship? And Gottman came up with, or he coined the phrase, emotional bank account.
It's actually, the emotional bank account was coined by Covey.
Covey?
Yeah, so okay. It's funny that you should mention Covey, Kay, but he actually used emotional bank account as just as a way of expressing the amount of trust that's been built up in a relationship. So, and it's a feeling of safeness you've got. So if I trust Paul, then I feel really safe with Paul. So that's a really important measure. And one of the things that doesn't happen in relationship is when the proverbial shit hits the fan. That's when we often don't feel safe, and we don't feel safe to express ourselves or anything because we're frightened that our partner sort of might bolt.
Or that we will not be looked after in the
the
situation or the transaction or the... I don't mean a transaction financially, although that could happen, but, you know, the result, the thing happening that, you know, I could lose out, I could be, you know, left on my own or that kind of thing. Okay, so really Gottman got into measuring this thing. So Covey's come up with the phrase, emotional bank account. Gottman's got into it and said, okay, if you think one-to-one is okay, then you kind of got it all skew-if. So do you want to talk about this?
Sure. Well, Gottman said one of the ways of measuring the balance in your bank account is using this 5-to-1 ratio, and that means that we've got to look at ways of. He said quite often a partner will move towards another partner they noticed, and they turn towards their partner. So turning towards is. No matter how small and no matter how subtle, if I turn towards Paul, whether it's to look at him, to talk to him, whatever, then that's a positive interaction. And the act of turning away is a negative interaction. So turning away can just be something simple like I don't even notice that he's made a gesture towards me.
I think he extended it more than physically, though. His thing about a positive or a negative was basically... a process. If I do something that is biased towards your needs, your desires, your preferences, those kind of things. So it could be like a turning towards you could be that I say something appreciative. Yeah. It could be that I ring to say, you know, like we used to do this a lot when I was traveling. I'd ring and I'd say, I'm just ringing to tell you that I love you because haven't got any news because you know what I've been doing. And he would call that a turning towards.
Yeah, turning towards is anything that we either of us do that is trying to enhance connection.
Yes, and quite often a turning away could be a nothing. In other words, we talk about I'd ring to say I'm just ringing to tell you that I love you, but the lack of a phone call can be interpreted as a turning away or as a negative, in as much as, you know, there's a bit of an issue because if you're expecting that I would, or if it seemed reasonable to you that I would, or that you were hoping that I would, and, you know, I just got busy, then we can have a negative that I don't even know happened.
Yeah.
And so the turning away and turning towards, he says, they put everything, they got every action that two people could have and categorize them into turning towards, turning away, and they call that positive and they call that negative. And then they started counting them up.
Right. And the ways that they reckon you to look at managing your bank account is we've got to make sure that as a couple that we focus on increasing the deposits in the emotional bank account and minimising the withdrawals. And that obviously means we have to increase the positive interactions and minimise any negative interaction. It's interesting what Paul was saying before. If he turns towards me by simply sending me a text message or anything and I ignore it, I don't even acknowledge it, then that's actually a turning away on my part. Yep. Not noticing him wanting to connect with me is a negative interaction from me. The other thing they said in terms of managing your bank account, your emotional bank account, is during conflict, we need to have 5 positive interactions to neutralise 1 negative one. So that's a pretty staggering number.
That was a bit that blew me away. Yeah. Was that, and I remember when we were teaching relationships courses, I used to walk around doing this all the time. And it was kind of like, you stuff up once and you make a mess. So, if I bugger up once, if I hurt you or if I insult you or I'm rude to you, then I got to get 5 of them into the thing to get even, right? It's not 5 to 1, it's 5 equals 1.
To make up for the 1, sure.
And for those of you wondering why the focus on the negative, why does the negative count more than the positive? We're actually hardwired that way. So if you go back to the times when we were tribal and we were wandering through the forest, then we're hardwired to find the negative, because if you don't, it might be fatal. So if you don't see the saber-toothed tiger hiding behind the tree, that could cost you your life.
Yeah.
So the problem with our hardwiring, the problem with what you've got between your ears, is that it's going to get that one negative and ramp it up. And that's why you can have a fantastic day, have one insult or one wrong thing, and what do you remember about the whole day? You can have, between the two of you, you can have the two of you having a brilliant day. Everything's gone right. Everything that could go right does go right. And then there's one hiccup, there's one thing, and it's kind of like the day's ruined. And you'll hear couples all the time saying, everything was going swimmingly, then it was fantastic. And then he ruined it all by saying, blah, there was one thing. And that one thing just goes like a hand grenade, and we can't, all the positives don't count. And that's because of that hardwiring thing. Therefore, you have to actually be on the front foot with the positives.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've kind of got to be working ahead of time and thinking, how do I get some deposits in the bank? I don't know whether it was Covey or Gottman who said, the reason we refer to it as an emotional bank account is that you can make as many withdrawals as you need. You just have to put the money in first.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the thing that they, in terms of managing the emotional bank account, there's the stat for during conflict, but also during everyday life, you have to have 20 positive interactions to every 1 negative interaction.
Yeah. It kind of adds up. And, it's one of those things where, I don't know if this is too personal or not, but I'll do it anyway. Back in 2003 when I got cancer and they said, you've got 3 years to live, I took a pretty serious hit. I probably should have been better than it, but nevertheless, that's the way it was. I got scared. So my own mortality, I was frightened that I was going to die and all of those sort of things. And my mind went to all sorts of negative imaginings, and that was, how are you and the girls going to survive? Nowadays I can say, of course you would survive, but, it was a focus around fear and all of that sort of stuff. And so I needed a lot of support, and that came from you and the girls in unmeasured quantities. When I think about what was going on, that was me making a withdrawal, right? I wasn't really capable of taking care of myself. And, you and the girls stepped in and that got me through it. The reality is you wouldn't have stepped in if I hadn't have been the kind of guy who'd been stepping in before.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of like one of those things where the bank account, it's just like a bank account. The thing that's not like a bank account is you can't overdraw it. And it won't work in the negative. So you have to have made the deposits before you can make the withdrawals. which means you have to go through life with a focus on how do I contribute to this relationship. And it's the thing that I see most people don't understand about relationships. And whether this is personal to me, whether it's, you know, you can tell me whether I'm crazy or not. But in my view, I don't understand why you or anybody else would want to stay with me if it wasn't fun, if it wasn't exciting, if it wasn't, if your life wasn't better with me than it was without me.
That may as well be on my own.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly less dramas.
Yeah.
There would be certainly less washing, cooking, ironing, and cleaning. So there'd be less work to do. Therefore, it seems to me that most people go into a relationship not knowing that they've got these needs that they want met. Like, you know, with the first stuff we did about Jack and Jane, the hero and the princess, they go in completely unaware that they've got an agenda they want their partner to meet, and they're going to be cranky with them when they meet that agenda, but they're going to have the pressure on them to meet that agenda. And also completely unaware of this thing where if I wanted you to hang around, it makes sense that I would make it fun or more fun to be here than to be somewhere else. What that means is I have to be going through life thinking about how do I make the relationship better because I'm in it. In other words, what is my contribution to our lives together, not what is my need? Because if I turn up needy, and everybody on this call has had someone in their life who's been needy, and it feels like an octopus got you and sucked on, and you might be able to pull one or two legs off, but the other five or six legs are firmly entwined on you, and they're going to suck you dry and take everything from you. So I can have a period of need, and it might be, you know, every week or every month or whatever it is, or like what we had in 2003 with the cancer. So I can have a period of need where, that might be short or it might be long. It could be a major life catastrophe, or it could be just, you know, having a shitty week. But it has to be overwhelmingly balanced the other way, where I'm thinking, what do I bring to the relationship? How do I, in my view, and this is just my personality, how do I make more fun? You know, one of my values in life is that it ought to be fun. You know, and you were talking the other day about me and Kai walking around the house. We're doing this renovation and the son-in-law is helping. Actually, the son-in-law is doing the renovation and I'm helping. But, you know, we're laughing and joking about who's got the pencil and who's stealing the tape measure and all that sort of stuff. And the process, particularly when my mate Johnny turns up, it's kind of like, you know, it's a day of laughing and joking. It's not a day of working. We're working, but it's laughing and joking. And that's because fun is one of my values, because I figure if you're going to have a life and it's not fun, what the bloody hell are you doing? You know, surely we weren't put here to be miserable. So I know that there are, I know everybody in this call knows someone who acts like we were put on life to be put on the planet to be miserable.
Yeah.
But I think we've got rocks in our head if we're not thinking, how do I make it surprising and delightful for my partner to bump into me today? You know, like when I come home from work, what energy am I bringing to the situation? What joy and fun and upliftment is my partner going to experience? Now, sure, I might be going home from work feeling knackered and feeling like, you know, shit, I just want to sit on the couch and have a beer. But if I'm not bringing something like that, and that's fair enough, right? Don't, you know, there are times when we all need to just sit on our asses and do nothing and be brought food. Okay, be brought chocolate and beer. So, but if that's a dominant experience, then you're just a bloody lead weight that everybody else has got to carry around. It's when you are a contribution because of the way that you run your life. I think that our relationship, you tell me, took a turn for the better when I finally got the gym into my life in a permanent fashion. Because the more I was looking after myself, the more energy I had, the more I was going somewhere, the more sense of direction I had, the more I had something to share, and the more fun I was to be around.
Speaking of that, and I don't know if I'm interrupting you or not, one of the things, you know, the slide here was talking about our emotional bank account. And one of the things we talked about, but it's only occurred to me now, we talked about the importance of the emotional bank account. And Gottman says, okay, well, there's three keys to managing that, and the managing that emotional bank account is going to really be looking after the emotional needs and relationship. And I was looking at that while you're talking, thinking, well, hang on a second, if I'm actually going to be looking after my own emotional needs, then I need to be making deposits myself into my emotional bank account, not just expecting you to be making deposits, or not expecting, but graciously receiving your deposits. So quite often during everyday life, we have negative thoughts about ourselves, or we make judgments about ourselves. And I think if you apply the same principles that Gottman's talking about, that means we've got to have 20 positive ones to make up for the one negative one we had. And if you're fighting with yourself, then you actually need five of them. So I think one of the things that we could all do is look at how we make some deposits in our own emotional bank account.
Yep. That boils down to what do you do for you? Yep. And that really is in the category of self-care, self-respect. And so I think that that's most easily, you know, if you want to frame a reference around that, you'll hear people in the personal development field all the time saying you've got to learn to love yourself. I don't understand how that's supposed to happen. What I do know is that so I don't know how to love myself. I do know how to look after myself. So that's in the category of self-respect. I would only look after myself if I had respect for myself. That means I've got to stop criticizing me. That means that when I make a mistake or I blow something or whatever, I step in front of the mirror and think, oh, you know, I'm too heavy, I'm too fat or whatever. Whilst that might be a fair call, I need to move on and say, well, what are you going to do about it? You're going to do anything or are you just going to whinge? So the reality is that, you know, it's not hard. It doesn't take skill or talent to be judgmental. And my experience is that most people are extremely self-critical. If there was one wish, you know, if you said to me, what is the one wish you would want for humanity? I think the thing that would work the most and make the biggest difference is if we could convince people to stop criticising themselves, the world would change in an instant.
Yeah, and our relationship would change in an instant.
And our relationship would change in an instant. Yeah. Because harder time I give myself, the more I need you to come along and make me feel better. Now, there's only a certain number of ways you can make me feel better. You know, and that's the five love languages. So if I want you to say nice stuff to me, well, that's great, except that now you've got another job, right? Yeah. And that is you're not just bringing up two children, you're bringing up three, because here's another child who's, you know, saying you've got to tell me you love me five times a day, and if you don't tell me five times a day, I get miserable. So that, you know, that's an obvious burden for you, and it's not a contribution, and sooner or later I would expect that you would come to your senses and you'd just go find someone else to be with, who, in my language, would be more fun.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Therefore, a lot of what you bring to your relationship revolves around what you do for yourself in terms of self-care, self-respect. So, you know, everyone on this call would be sick of me talking about get yourself to the gym, look after what you eat, all that sort of stuff. So I'm not going to bother with it right now. But what I'm going to say is self-care and self-respect are fundamental to a high-quality relationship that makes you feel like you're lucky to be in it.
One of the things that we've been talking about, the emotional bank account and how to make sure that we manage it, and that's what John Gottman says is the best way for us to invest in the future of our relationships. And one of the things that they found in the love labs were there were particular signs that a relationship was doomed and it was going to be over. And what he called these four signs were the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And that's because he coined that term from mythology, because this was the death knell. And yep. So let's have a look at, okay, well, here are the four things. And the very first thing that shows up is criticism. And he says there's an antidote for each one of these things. So
this, once again, come from the Love Lab, and this is where they're predicting how things were going to go. So where there is criticism, that's okay. Maybe I need the criticism. When the criticism is constructive, then that's going to work to our advantage, because that shows me that Mary respects me and cares about me and is telling me things that I need to change for my own good. Where the criticism is an attack on my personality or on my character, then that's going to bring the relationship undone, because I'm only going to hang around for so long.
And the way to make sure that that doesn't turn up is if I start the conversation gently. So I can use Dobbs's term and say, hey, we're about to have a domestic call. So the gentle startup is one of the things that will actually stop your partner feeling criticised.
I think that, you know, criticism of another is actually an extension of criticism of self. The more I criticise myself, the more harsh and judgmental I am with myself, the more that extends out to other people, particularly people that I'm close to, because the problem with us being close is that because we see each other all the time, then simple things get left out. So do you mind if we kind of go on a side tangent for a second?
I don't know where you're going.
Okay. One of the things that I see happening in relationship is that we get used to each other. You know, familiarity breeds contempt. So what happens is that I say to lots of couples, your troubles started when you moved in together. When you were living separately, things were going fine. Because, you see, when you live in a separate house, if you're going to see each other, you have to make a date. And make an effort. And it's quite a significant effort, because what it means is, okay, I'm going to put some time in the diary where I'm not going to be anywhere else. And so I'm going to have to get my washing, cooking, ironing and cleaning done some other time. I'm going to have to arrange to go out, meet you at some place, spend some time with you. And, you know, the activity, whether it's movies or dinner or whatever, is about spending time with you, right? Now, you look at our current day situation where we move in together. And in yours and my case, we've usually had someone else with us, right? For the last, your mum lived with us for 25 years. So, you know, lots of common interaction. And what that means is, as soon as we move in together, then the washing, cooking and ironing and cleaning becomes part of the everyday thing. So we don't make a date to see each other. Most couples don't have date night. And because they don't have date night, or if they do, it's only one night a week, because that's what date night sounds like. You know, if we were before we were married, before we're together, before we lived in the same house, we would have seen each other 4 or 5 times a week. I remember turning up on the bike and grabbing you and you'd stick the helmet on and off we'd go somewhere. That would happen 4 or 5 times a week. That's 4 or 5 times in a week where there was specific time spent just being with each other, even though we might be sitting in a park having a picnic, or we might be at the beach, or we might be doing something. So there was an activity that took place which was designed to be something that kind of occupied us while we spent time together.
Brought us together.
Yeah. And it would seem like a bit odd to not be brought together to do something. Like I don't ever remember just going sitting in a park and doing nothing. So the activity looks like it's a thing, but it isn't. So nowadays we don't spend, there's not 4 or 5 times in an ordinary week where you and I get in the car, go somewhere for the purpose of doing something that throws us together. Unless you count going to Bunnings, right? And that exactly doesn't throw us together. It ain't that much fun. So, and we don't even get the Bunnings 4 or 5 times a week. So, I think that one of the things that most couples don't realise is that the active building and depositing in the bank account requires these little things that we don't do because we live together all the time. And so, instead of, you know, I jump on the bike right around to your place at an appointed time and we go out somewhere, we just pass in the kitchen, I squeeze your ass and say I love you and that's it. And that's really kind of like a pretty poor substitute for, you know, like the only bit that works is squeeze your ass, and that probably doesn't work for you as much as it does for me. So, it's kind of... It's a source for self-criticism, because you most often say, that ass is too big to be squeezing or whatever it is. So, you know, we're kind of a long way down the track of that being a good thing. But that might be the only kind of, you know, venture towards connecting in a normal day. And, you know, even when we cook, it's kind of like, you know, you might cook for me, I might cook for you, but it's kind of like I cooked for you. Oh, thanks, Dale. That's really great. There you go. Boom. Sit down, watch TV. Have it while we watch TV. We never did that when we were dating. So I think it's really important that we think about what we physically do that negates the fact that we live in the same house. I think for many couples, living in the same house is a kiss of death on the relationship. And of course, it provides grounds for this criticism because you don't put your stuff away, or you don't put the garbage out, or you never do this, or when are you ever going to fucking do that? Or other stuff where the grounds for criticism is actually we're surrounded by it because you didn't paint the wall, or you didn't fix this, or you didn't do that, or you didn't wash up, or vacuum, or what the hell. So the first horsemen, and that's Gottman called them the four horsemen because he called them the four horsemen of the apocalypse because they will turn up and they'll completely ruin your relationship. Second one was contempt. And no, this is the one about the dimple muscle. You want to explain the dimple muscle?
No, you can.
Okay, so with this video that they were able to watch 90 seconds of video, right? So just you and your partner having breakfast and they were watching the video with no sound. And what they noticed was when criticism got stronger then, and it went into the attack of personality or character, then what happens was we start to express contempt for our partner. And so that's when we're attacking their intent and we're insulting or abusing. And what they noticed was what happens with contempt is that there's a muscle just here. No, it's just there. No wonder you're not talking about it. You don't know about it. It's a muscle just out here. It's what you might call the sneer muscle. They call it the dimpler muscle. And basically what it does is when you do this, so watch carefully. I'm going to lean in. When we do that, that's the dimpler muscle. And, of course, most people wouldn't recognise that. You could be sitting at dinner with a dozen other people and you sneer at your partner for something that they said and your face goes like that and no one else notices that microscopic movement on your face. But your partner does because they're used to seeing you and they take that as extreme judgment and rejection. And so by the time we get to contempt, then things are pretty much in deep yogurt. The solution, of course, is to go in the opposite direction, and that is to suspend judgment. It takes a big heart, but it's worth it. If you can operate from the position of a big-hearted approach to your relationship, then what you will do is you will start to build a culture of appreciation for each other.
And that sort of doesn't mean John Gottman's not saying, well, when you see the dimple muscle turn up and you're seeing contempt. You don't then turn around and try and start building a culture of appreciation in that moment. What he's saying is generally, if you're actually appreciating your partner, you're putting those deposits in the emotional bank account, then contempt won't surface. Yeah. So it's not when he says what's the antidote. It isn't an antidote in the moment. It's an antidote that's going to prevent contempt turning up.
Yes, so the culture of appreciation is something you have to build by these 20-to-1 deposits in the positive bank account, what he calls a turning towards. But they're the going out of your way to take the opportunity to make a positive impact on your partner, which for many people this is difficult because it involves being creative. And if you call yourself a non-creative person, which is kind of like not really true, then the reality is it's not that you're not creative, it's that you're not practiced at being creative. And we can take the easy way out and go, oh, I can't think of anything for dinner. That's practicing non-creativity. There's a million recipe books out there. We could find something new for dinner in 10 seconds. It's an effort that's important. So those are the first two. The third of the four horsemen is called defensiveness. And basically what he's saying is by the time you get to being defensive, things are seriously downhill. That effectively what's going on is that defensiveness is kind of like, I've had enough of attack. I've had enough of feeling criticized and I'm trying to reverse things and get out of feeling like it's me that's always the problem. And defensiveness is about like, you know, we suffered a lot from this early in our relationship when, you know, without all of the preamble we've been talking about, I'd say to Mary, you just buggered that up. And Mary would say, well, that's the fourth thing I've buggered up today. I can't get anything right. You know, it's never, I'm never good enough. And that's a version of flooding is, you know, I can never get it right. I can, you know, there's always something for you to criticise. It doesn't work, blah, 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 blah. That's
or
defensive.
I could say, me, what about you?
What about you? Cool. Talk about taking responsibility and what you mean, how that kind of undoes the defensiveness.
Yeah, because, what happens if you take responsibility? If I take responsibility, it means that I don't have to try and shift the blame over there. Because shifting the blame over there is what is going to make you defensive. If I take responsibility, then there's nothing to defend.
Yeah. Okay. So that means finding or answering that question, that's my favourite question, which is what have you come to teach me?
Yeah, and the other thing that's really important about taking responsibility is sometimes I might need to say, oh, look, I'm really sorry, I totally got that wrong.
And I might need to say that as well.
Yeah, I'd probably find it easier to say than you would.
You do find it easier to say than I do because I was taught at a very early age, not necessarily by my parents, that if I was wrong, I was substandard, that I was unacceptable. So I was not allowed to get things wrong or to make a mistake. And, of course, you know, if you look at our culture, there's public criticism of people who say they got it wrong. So, for example, our politicians will never admit that they got it wrong or made a mistake. For the rest of us, it's an act of courage to say I got it wrong. And we admire the people who admit to their mistakes. You know, it's an interesting thing. When we look at what goes on in our local life, then we see the act of courage when someone says, I'm responsible, you know, I stuffed it up. In our leaders, we, you know, they for some reason think that they have to be invincible and never wrong and whatever. And it's odd to me that they don't get it because none of them seem to have worked out why Jacinta Ardern is so popular. And the reality is that she's just been human, which is what we're talking about in this process, is saying where I'm at, what I'm feeling, what I'm going through, and not requiring that anybody agrees with me or sympathises with me or makes it right or whatever. Finally, we come to stonewalling, and essentially we've described stonewalling pretty thoroughly, so you guys will be pretty familiar with that. But this psychological self-soothing, I reckon that's a shit word, soothing.
Physiological, in other words.
Physiological, did I say psychological?
Yeah. So okay. All that means is if I'm feeling so frightened that I'm actually going to stonewall so that I don't feel anything, then I need to work out what's going to make me feel better and go do that and then come back and talk to you.
Cool. So there's two things we're saying here. In the last session, what I was saying, well, I was recommending this to the blokes, is when they know they're stonewalling, they should go inside and find out what they're feeling.
Yeah.
And it's going to be feelings of endangerment, vulnerability, victimisation, all of those, you know, any of those things, predominantly negative things. But what you're saying at the same time is I should go play with the lawnmower in terms of fixing it. I should go in the shed or the cave because physiologically that slows my heart rate, calms me down.
You're looking after yourself.
Okay. Or any other thing that does that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, my grandmother, she used to do tatting, and I can see now that was a self-soothing activity. I used to think when I was a kid, she used to knit and she used to do tatting. And as a kid, I used to think she couldn't talk if she wasn't knitting. She'd sit there with my mum and it was kind of like yabber away. And I didn't know how the needles could do what they were doing without her looking at them. And if she ever got something wrong, she'd stop and she'd stop talking to my mum while she brought her brain to it and then go back. But obviously there's something about that kind of activity. Okay. What I'm going to recommend to all of you is that you find some kind of self-soothing activity that has the following characteristics. The most powerful self-soothing, I hate this combination of words, the most powerful combination of self-soothing activities is something where your entire brain goes to it. You have to be focused to make it happen or it won't. So I used to race go-karts. The thing about racing go-karts is that, or racing anything, is you've got to make it go as fast as you can, and that means getting as close as you can to losing traction and spinning off the track. So it takes intense concentration. And so we'd race in teams, and I'd do half an hour, and I'd get, and my mate would get in, and after that half an hour, I'd be covered in dirt and grease and sweat and slime and all the rest of it, but I'd be exhilarated. And the exhilaration was from the single focus activity. Some people go fishing. Some people go gardening. There are lots of self-soothing activities. Most of them are not practical because if you've got to go fishing, you know, well, you've got to stop doing what you're doing and jump in the car and drive there and get your boat out and do all that sort of stuff. So the self-soothing activities at work are the ones that can be done between your ears. So what is the self-soothing activity that works best for you? And I'm going to suggest to all of you that you could be better at meditating, but meditating doesn't have to be it. You can practice mindfulness. There's a whole bunch of brain-biased activities that require that you focus on the one thing. And as you focus on that one thing, the rest of the world drops away. And when the rest of the world drops away, you're getting the self-soothing activity or the results of the self-soothing activity, physiologically speaking. Does that make sense to you?
It sure does.
Cool. All right. Anything else to add on that?
John, I put a comment in chat. Julie said, can I tell you what it is? Because for me, whether it's anger, frustration, confusion, I really find that I just go and do my meditations. And the larger part of me tells me what the real issue is, and then I can work on what's really bothering me, because sometimes you don't know what it is.
Oh,
you know, it's the trigger, but that's not necessarily what the issue is.
I would say what presents is usually not the issue.
Yeah.
And
so, I've got to meditate to find out what the issue is.
Thanks, John. That's a great observation.
Yeah, I asked you to unmute, John, because they don't, for all of you, they're not looking at the chat box. So if you want to speak to them, just unmute and interrupt.
Thanks, Jules.
No worries. I don't have the chat box on my screen because I need to see other parts of the screen. So thanks for that. I would add to that, John, that I think that reveals something that's really important, is that what we mostly do is we struggle with surface emotions. So as you say, it can be anger, it can be sadness, it can be fear, it could be, you know, frustration, it could be anything that's, you know, happened at work or at home that you're feeling that. And we tend to struggle with whatever it is. And so when I'm stressed, I want the things that are stressing me to go away, instead of sitting down, going inside and saying, okay, what is my stress reaction to? And generally what I'll find is that I'm being asked to do something, even if I'm being asked by myself, to do something that I can't do or think that is beyond my capacity or beyond my time constraints or whatever, and the demands on me are unfair or I'm unable to meet them. And really, whilst on the surface it's stress, underneath it is actually not frustration, it's disappointment with myself about my level of performance, that I can't perform well enough to make all this shit go away and to make it, you know, smooth and cool, calm and collected, those kind of things. You know, we had an incident the other day where I was really stressed because there was more to do than I could get done, and there were competing demands. And if I was going to do this bit, I'll put my hand on the screen. If I was going to do that bit, this bit was going to suffer. But if I did that bit, this bit was going to suffer, and there was no two ways about it. And so it looked frustrating, and I wanted one of these things to go away. And Mary said, well, you know, how can I help you? Well, she couldn't help me because she couldn't do these things that I needed to do. So she couldn't help, but that was chewing up more time, her asking, how can I help? So I'm going, could you just go away? Could you go away? Because I need to figure this out. But really, I'm frustrated with my feelings of inadequacy, but I thought it was stress. And I think that what you're saying, John, is that when you have a reliable mechanism, for you it's meditating, for me it's meditating, for lots of people it's meditating, but it could be anything else. When you have a reliable mechanism that takes you within, and you get to deal with the real feeling instead of the one that you think because it's the one that's on the surface. And if ever there was a thing I see people suffer from, it's dealing with the surface emotion and not getting anywhere because they're not dealing with the one that's underneath that. Make sense? Make sense to you? Cool. Anything else anybody wants to add or questions to ask at this point?
You going, Paul? It's Nick. I find with myself, I mean, I work away, so I'm FIFO. So basically, I've had a few issues at work. Funny you should bring that up, with a certain person, and I tend to, like I've said before, I bottle it up. A situation arose where he was having a crack at me, this, that, and the other, and I just blew me top. I just told him how it was, basically. Not only that, you spoke as well about knocking yourself, about not doing this, that, and the other, not being positive. I know where you're coming from in that degree, because I do a lot of that myself, not being able to finish things on time and this, that, and the other. And I found that, you know, sometimes I'll just take five, go to a corner, and just basically let things ride out sometimes. And then, I'm not saying it goes away all the time, but a lot of the time it just seems to plateau out and start from scratch, I suppose, you know. But knocking yourself, not being confident, and getting that comfort zone, I would most probably call that more things. Yeah. As well, getting out of your comfort zone to try and get to a different level when you work, whatever the case may be, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, what you're talking about is methods for emotional management.
Mm.
Because what happens is the heat, you know, with the person criticizing you at work, as the heat goes up, typically, I think you're a FIFO worker too, aren't you, Nick?
Yeah, that's correct.
So typically, yep. That's going to be an all-male environment. Would that be right?
95%, yep.
Okay. So it'll be blunt, it'll be blustery, it's kind of blokes working hard in the heat kind of thing. So it very quickly gets aggressive. It very quickly gets to I'm right and you're wrong.
Yeah. Well, he's basically my direct supervisor. And obviously, I'm a bit tentative to knock him because he's my supervisor, you know what I mean? It gets to me a bit, where is, am I going to lose my job? Because we're not permanent, we're casual permanent. So you've got to be, I look at it, you've got to be a bit careful where you tread.
Yeah.
Because am I going to come back this itch, or, you know, especially in this environment at the moment as it is. I mean, unfortunately, I've been laid off, but at the moment, which hopefully we're going back to work soon, but getting away from that, basically it's he always seems to be on my back, and I've actually hit him up a couple of times about it, and after I've hit him up about it a couple of times, it does peter away for 2-3 days, and it seems to go back to normality the way it was before. I'm all the way, I mean, it's not just being noticed by me, it's being noticed by the other guys on my crew as well, where he's basically come across the wrong way. And I've gone to other guys and said, well, is it me or what? Why am I being picked on the such, you know? And they said, well, we don't know, you know. But, yeah. But anyway.
Yeah, so one of the things I recommend is that you do that walking away. That's a piece of emotional management. It's important that you walk away because it stops you blowing your stack and, you know,
yep.
Either punching him or insulting him or whatever.
That's not in my, I won't even go down that track. But I know what you mean by walking away and just cool off for a bit and just veg out for a bit.
The second thing I'd do is that I'd suggest to you that one of the things that will be extremely helpful to you is to ask yourself, what is his motivation?
His motivation is he's been picked on by somebody above.
Yeah.
And it's been suggested to me as well by a couple of other people in his same position, but he's got actually a little bit of anxiety. As soon as somebody says jump and they're higher above him, he jumps, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And it's not just me that said it either. A few people have actually said that. He's got a little, under himself, he's got a bit of emotion as well.
Yeah. So what I'm going to recommend to you is this. When we do that, when we say what is their motivation, what we do is we take the heat off ourselves, because we very quickly understand they're out of control. So, for example, when I said to you, what is his motivation, had I been forced to answer that question myself, I would have said fear. The only reason people jump all over other people is that they're afraid that they're going to look bad if the other people aren't working hard enough or getting the result or whatever. So it's like it's London to a brick that is driven by fear. The word you used was anxiety. So at that level, you can approach from a different perspective, and that is to say, listen, mate, I know you're under the pump. I know you've got to jump on someone, but on this occasion, you're wasting your time because I'm going as hard as I can. In other words, what you can do is you can acknowledge that the problem is over there, not over here. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Times when you can do that and times when you can't. When you say to this guy, listen, mate, I know you're under the pump. I know people are jumping all over you to get you to jump all over us and all that sort of stuff. There are times when that statement is an insult, and there are times when that statement is an acknowledgement of he's behaving badly because, you know, there's no other alternative. So you've got to use your judgment about when you say that kind of thing, because quite often you don't even need to say it, because if you know that it's not that, if you know that that's what's doing it, then it's not personal. And what you can do is you can depower it by saying to yourself, this is not personal. We just need someone's ass to kick in today. It's mine. And if that's what we're doing today, well, that's okay. Just give me the money and kick my ass.
I mean, a lot of times I do that. I just don't. That's the trouble with me over the years. I've been the quiet mouse, as to say. You know, I'm not somebody that really speaks up. But,
yeah, you'll probably find it's not doing you that much good.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for mentioning that, mate. We will talk a little bit more about that kind of thing in the next break. We're a couple of minutes over, but we've still got 13 minutes to grab a cup of tea or run to the loo or whatever it is. So we'll see you all at 2 o'clock. Ready, set, go.